In many ways, abortion was on the ballot this past election, and there's reason for concern. There are many counties, cities, and states who have radicalized abortion, and thousands of tiny babies will continue to lose their lives every day. Which is why the Ministry of Preborn is on the front lines for at-risk babies and mothers with unplanned pregnancies. Preborn sponsors clinics positioned in the highest abortion areas in the country by providing them with resources that they need to rescue babies. Preborn continues to expand their life-affirming care. Their end-of-year goal is to equip 10 more clinics with ultrasound machines. These life-saving machines cost $15,000 each, more than most clinics can afford. When a woman meets her baby on ultrasound, she is twice as likely to choose life. And when she comes to a preborn clinic, she will also be embraced with God's love. $28 sponsors one ultrasound, and now through a match, your gift is doubled. How many babies can you save? Please donate. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 and say the keyword baby. Or you can go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible, and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating.
We inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core. Walker Wildman here on American Family Radio. The show is At the Core, and this is a brand new live edition of the show. Glad to have you with us here on American Family Radio. As a brief reminder, and those of you who listen daily and are loyal listeners, you hear the same talking points every day, but in those who know the radio space know that new listeners are coming in every minute, quite literally. So I like to remind our audience how to keep up with the program by simply subscribing to the podcast. So we upload the show each afternoon in the form of a podcast, and it can be delivered right to your smartphone, your smart device, by going to your podcast library, type in At the Core, click the subscribe button on this show, and you will have it queued up in your library each and every day. And we have over 25,000 of you who subscribe to the podcast, who listen to the podcast every single month. And so let's keep those numbers rolling upward. And we can do that by having you subscribe. Just go to your podcast library, type in At the Core, click the subscribe or the follow button, and we'll queue it up in your library each and every afternoon. Well, John chapter 3 is where we are this week. We talked a little bit about this on Monday. But here in John chapter 3, in the first, let's say, verses 1 through 6, basically, Jesus is talking to Nicodemus about being born of the Spirit. And this is a completely foreign concept, not for Jesus, but for the Jews. And that is being born of the Holy Spirit and how that is the regenerating power of God in each believer, which is a distinct difference of how people were saved or experienced salvation in the Old Testament through their faith. Here, each believer is who believes in Jesus as the Messiah is granted salvation and granted the Holy Spirit. And so obviously this is a New Testament concept of salvation, where Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and God's Spirit lives in each and every believer. Each and every believer is anointed by God with His power and His power to ultimately overcome the grave that was delivered to us, made available to us through Jesus. And so Jesus here in John chapter 3 is communicating this, introducing this to Nicodemus, and it's just mind-boggling to Nicodemus and the Jews. You know, they're like, how can somebody be born twice? I don't understand. And Jesus basically says, hey, you're missing the point. We're not talking a literal birth here out of the womb. We're talking a spiritual birth, being spiritually born again. That is what Jesus is talking about. And so now we know that every believer, everyone who trusts and has faith in Jesus as the Son of God for salvation is born of the Spirit. That's John chapter 3, probably the first 5 to 6 verses there. All right, let's talk some news, talk some current events, and then we'll have a couple guests on the rest of the program. But I do want to mention, speaking of news and events, we're going to Israel and Greece in 2026 in March, and registration for those trips is going to close in December. And so if you've been procrastinating, and I've actually talked to some of you who've said, yeah, I want to go to that, well, the clock is ticking, and so you've got about a couple weeks left before registration closes on that. So if you want to go with us to Israel, the land of the Bible, or Greece to discover the footsteps of Paul, then you can do one or both of those trips coming up in March of 2026. WildmanGroup.com is the URL. WildmanGroup.com is that URL. Well, the midterms are now under 12 months away, under 12 months away. And it seems like yesterday we had the 2024 election. Well, time is moving quickly, and we are near the halfway mark for President Trump's first 2 years. So we're January will be 12 months in office for President Trump for this second term. And the House of Representatives is the main chamber, I will say, at stake here. Okay. So if we're looking at the landscape, and then I've got some, this isn't just a, you know, the importance of voting talk. I'm going to talk about what Congress or what Republicans need to do to get their house in order, pun fully intended. The midterms for the president's party, the historical trend here is just not good for the Republicans. It's just not good for the majority party when their president is in the White House. That's just a historical fact. So, pretty much over since World War II, the president's party has lost the majority seat in the House of Representatives 26 out of 28 times, I believe. Don't quote me on that, but I'm in the ballpark. 26 out of 28 times, which means only 2 times over that period of time has the majority party defied those odds, all right? And I think one was under Clinton, the other one was under Bush. And my point in saying that is that statistically speaking, not even looking at the current landscape, just looking at history, the Republicans do not bode well in November, all right? That's just a fact. That's a historical fact based on statistics. Now, let's look at the current landscape. I'm not going to spend time on New Jersey, Virginia, even though we could probably do some diagnosing there and how Democrats ran the show in those two states. The Democrats are motivated. Let's not forget this, all right? The Democrat base is motivated. They are radical, they are rabid, and they are motivated, all right? If you don't believe me, look at the sheer energy that the likes of AOC and the squad and others can bring about in the Democrat base, okay? And so the Democrats have their energy. Whether we want to accept it or not, there is a large block of the Democrat Party that just wants to do anything that they can to oppose Donald Trump. All right. It's not based on policy. It's not based really on much of ideology. It's really based on this unfounded, irrational hatred of Donald Trump that has been festering in our country for now over a decade, going back to 2015. And this environment has been fostered because of the rhetoric that the media and the Democrat Party use against President Trump. They've created him into this big, bad figure of the right that must be defeated at all cost. That's their words, not mine. And so the Democrats are going to have their energy. That's my point here. The Democrats will have their energy, and they will especially have their energy because they haven't been in power for 2 years in any chamber, all right? And so I'm going to give you a couple reasons why the Democrats being in charge of Congress is bad for the conservative movement in 2027. We've been here before. And if you want to jog your memory, then go read about 2018 and 2019. Specifically, 2019 and 2020, to be exact. January of 2019 would have been when the 2018 midterm class was sworn in. That's the Nancy Pelosi class, okay? And we had impeachment after impeachment. We had budget battle after budget battle. And it was a circus. And President Trump, and I have all sympathy for him, he had to deal with House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi for 2 years, all right? Including during the 2020 election scandal that it was. And January 6th, all of that was under Nancy Pelosi's leadership. If you thought that was rough, then just hang on if Hakeem Jeffries is the House Majority Leader in 2027. Now this isn't a foregone conclusion, okay? Now, when you look at the statistical probability, you go, it's probably a foregone conclusion. And you may be right. But there are things that Republicans can do to maintain control of the House. Now, it's a heavy lift, all right? And they could do everything right and still not keep control of the House. But they need to, all right? And so the first, I'm just going to give you, to keep it simple, two reasons why Hakeem Jeffries doesn't need to be the majority leader, all right? Number one is because there will be witch hunt after investigation, after hearing, after, you know, impeachment, and they will impeach. They don't have to have a reason. We've seen that. They just impeach to impeach. Orange man bad. They'll do that, and they'll do it for 2 years straight. Never ending, all right? So it will be distraction after distraction, CNN, MSNBC, 24/7 coverage of House impeachment trial of Donald Trump. President Trump has to lawyer up, hire dozens of attorneys, spend countless hours prepping, all a big waste of time and a distraction for the executive branch, all right? Second reason, Hakeem Jeffries has primary negotiating priority and control over the budget, all right? So President Trump passed reconciliation, was able to get the One Big Beautiful Bill through, permanency of some of the tax cut, some new tax incentives brought in, the full border wall funded through the One Big Beautiful Bill, Planned Parenthood defunded through Medicaid reimbursements for up to 12 months. Pretty big win, not as big as we would like, but nonetheless a win. And so there was a lot of conservative victories, Department of Homeland Security through Immigration and Customs Enforcement, given billions of additional funds to hire up to 100,000 ICE agents to help secure the mass deportation of illegal immigrants in our country, the 400,000 unaccounted for children that they're currently doing welfare checks on between now and November. That's taking place because of the funding of Congress through the One Big Beautiful Bill. And so I don't want to quickly move past the victories that have already been had. And we're not even talking about the judicial appointments that President Trump is putting forth, which are now going through the Senate in a pretty expedited manner. so we can get constitutionalist judges on the bench. We're working on that. But the budget, the House is the originator of the government budget. That's per the Constitution. And you put Hakeem Jeffries in charge of the House of Representatives, the entire process will be marred from day one. They will have the Green New Deal back in the budget. They will have the tax credits for the electric vehicles back in the budget. They will have all their left-wing non-governmental organizations funded through the budget. They will defund President Trump's immigration enforcement operations. They will rescind funding for the border wall that was passed in the One Big Beautiful Bill. If you don't think I'm serious, then you haven't been paying attention. The Democrats just shut down the government for 40-plus days over one Obamacare subsidy. And that's in the minority. They did that in the minority. You think the Democrats won't shut down the government for an indefinite period of time to ensure that President Trump's border wall does not get built? You're wrong. It will happen. And so Republicans should fight like their lives depend on it to ensure they keep the House of Representatives. We'll be back in a few.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of American Family Association and American Family Radio. Hey, 2026 is your year to go with us on one of our Christian Heritage Tours. We've got some dynamite tours lined up for 2026. We're going to Colonial Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. We're also going to Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, and we'll see George Washington's Mount Vernon estate while we're there, too. And then we're going to Boston and to Concord and to Lexington. All the history in Boston. We'll also be meeting with a couple of our founding fathers. The D.C. and Williamsburg tours are in June and September, and the Boston tour is in September. So if you want to go with us, you want to see the pricing, the itinerary, everything, go to wildmangroup.com, W-I-L-D-M-O-N, group.com, wildmangroup.com, and we hope to see you on one of our 2026 tours.
At the Core podcasts are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the second segment of today's program. Walker Wildman here with you live on American Family Radio. Glad to have those of you tuned in listening to today's program. Well, if you've been listening to AFR in recent weeks and even in recent years, you've heard us talk about Operation Christmas Child and our partnership with Samaritan's Purse. And most of you, at least myself speaking, have participated in the annual shoebox campaign. I've actually been on a delivery trip with Samaritan's Purse and talked about The Greatest Journey, which is their discipleship program. So we're going to talk about that with Isabella McMillan now. She's a representative and a spokesperson with Operation Christmas Child. And Isabella is joining us now. Isabella, glad to have you on the program.
So glad to be here and so thankful for our partnership with Family Radio.
Thanks, Isabella. Well, every year we have on a representative, and almost every year it's someone who's been personally impacted by the shoebox campaign. And of course, that's you. So give us a little bit about your story, and then we'll talk about the specifics of the shoebox campaign.
I am originally from Romania. I was born and raised in the time of communism in Romania, where every aspect of our life was controlled by the government, from where we could live to where my parents could work, where we could go to school, even what grocery store we could get our ratioed coupon groceries at. And the biggest thing the government was trying to control during that time is to make sure that God's name was not known in our country. So going to church, owning a Bible, those things would have cost our lives. And so in an environment like that, we didn't go to church. But I'm so grateful that our God is a God who tells us in John 1:5 that the light shines in the darkness and the darkness will never be able to overcome it. And he opened the door for us in a very unexpected way when I was 7, when my brother and I found a hidden Bible in the floorboards of our little government-owned apartment. And that is how we were first exposed to God's word.
That's amazing. Help our listeners who maybe they think about a shoebox and they think, how is that really going to help people? And in the American context, I understand, you know, people kind of think, I don't know if that's an impactful gift. But in parts of the world where you guys are delivering these shoeboxes, the vast majority of the parts of the world that you're delivering them to are, many of them are impoverished to some degree or another. And these children just don't have a lot. I mean, they're fortunate to even have shoes on their feet. So just talk about the impact of something so simple, but yet for the recipient, it's just a very big deal for them.
Well, for so many of us, items that we place in a shoebox, like school supplies and hygiene items and small toys, they look so insignificant. But for someone like me, my most vivid memories of my mom and dad during my childhood are watching them every single night around our little kitchen table, huddled up and strategizing night after night, how they're going to feed us the next day. That was their biggest problem on their mind. So when they're trying to figure out how to feed us, something like having school supplies and toys was not on the priority list. And can I tell you that I was the coolest kid at school for months after I received my shoebox gift, because I had school supplies like no one else did. And I loved every single one of them. Never seen colored markers before in my life. We did not know crayons even existed. We actually tried to taste them at first because we didn't know what to do with them. But just the very simple things that our kids here probably will not be excited to receive for Christmas can mean so much. And sometimes even the difference between life or death, meaning they would either go to school with the school supplies they have or join a gang when they would lose their life. It's literally that severe in so many countries. So I just want to encourage all of our listeners, do not think that this is too small to make a difference, because God can use ordinary things to do extraordinary things with them.
Absolutely. And so, folks, we're encouraging you to participate. This is National Collection Week up until November 24th, and you can go to SamaritansPurse.org/OCC, SamaritansPurse.org/OCC. Well, Isabella, tell us a little bit about your time at Samaritan's Purse, how long you've been working with the ministry, and what your role is today.
I have been involved with Operation Christmas Child since 2004, so a little over 21 years now. Have been packing shoeboxes when I discovered Operation Christmas Child on this end, and I realized I can be part of giving back now instead of being on the receiving end. But for the last 18 years, I have been a spokesperson for the ministry, been packing shoeboxes with my family since my kids could walk and talk, and now they're 16 and 13 years old. And I serve now full-time with Operation Christmas Child. I am so grateful that God took that moment when I received my shoebox, when he answered a very specific prayer for me through that shoebox. And that was the day when I told him I will serve him for the rest of my life, and had no idea this is what it would look like. But I am so grateful that I get to pack shoeboxes now on this end alongside of all of our listeners.
Absolutely. Well, Isabella, thank you so much for coming on, and we appreciate the work you're doing over at Samaritan's Purse, and we'll keep highlighting it until the deadline next week.
Thank you so much. This is National Collection Week. I hope that everyone packs a shoebox.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Isabella. Appreciate you coming on.
God bless you.
All right. There you have it, SamaritansPurse.org. That was Isabella McMillan, spokesperson and representative with Samaritan's Purse, also one-time recipient of the shoebox that changed her life, and she's been working with Samaritan's Purse for over 20 years now, since 2004, and excellent testimony there, and that's just one of many, many stories, hundreds of thousands of stories, probably millions over the years of kids that are impacted by the shoebox, and many of them come to Christ as well. And by the way, Samaritan's Purse offers The Greatest Journey, which is their discipleship program, to follow up the shoebox campaign. So you're not just sending a physical gift, you're sending The Greatest Journey to follow that up for those children that accept Christ. And then they partner with the local church and have a discipleship program, which I've helped facilitate and kind of oversee, at least on a trip or two with Samaritan's Purse. So your gift is making a true impact on their lives. So we appreciate them coming on to talk about that. This is a National Collection Week for the shoeboxes up until the 24th of November, SamaritansPurse.org/OCC. All right, shifting gears and back to the legislative branch and the Senate specifically in their advise and consent role on federal presidential appointments. I do have an op-ed that I will get this over to Bobby in short order, but this op-ed that I wrote was published just this morning in the Heartlander News, which is out of Missouri, and I'm going to drop this to Bobby in the comments on our rundown document. But what we've done with this op-ed is we've, just to give you a little backgrounder, there's currently a vacancy that has just been announced on the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which obviously Missouri is part of that. And so the 8th Circuit now has a judicial vacancy. One of the judges there, Dwayne Benton, was announced his senior status just recently in late October. And so this creates a vacancy where President Trump gets to appoint a replacement for this seat on the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals. And throughout our research over at AFA Action, we have names that we've researched, that we feel confident in, that we recommend to the president. And so the name that we're recommending, and this is pretty much summarized in the op-ed, is Aaron Hawley. Aaron Hawley is an attorney with the Alliance Defending Freedom, with their Center for Life and Regulatory Practice. Prior to joining ADF, Hawley was an appellate attorney at Kirkland and Ellis, these are law firms, and Bancroft and King and Spalding, that's another law firm as well. And so Aaron Hawley, when we did our research on Aaron Hawley, she has extensive experience litigating before both the U.S. Supreme Court and the lower federal courts, including courts of appeal. And she's been a professor and involved in constitutional litigation and teaching that as a professor. She's also taught on taxation, agricultural law, and much of her time teaching as a professor has been related to the federal court system as well. And so I mentioned all of that background to recommend that this op-ed that we'll link on the show notes is me recommending Aaron Hawley for this seat on the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals. And if you're asking yourself, or you're saying to yourself, that last name sounds familiar, it's because it is familiar. Aaron is the wife of Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri. And so Aaron is obviously Josh's wife, and she is an attorney. And so she would be an excellent fit for this seat. And our job is to get the word out there and to begin this conversation and have the public, and specifically those who live within the jurisdiction of the 8th Circuit, which includes Missouri, to begin talking about Aaron Hawley so we can lobby for her within the U.S. Senate, within the Judiciary Committee, and ultimately with the president himself, President Trump. So Aaron Hawley is who we're recommending for this 8th Circuit vacancy, and she would make an excellent judge should President Trump appoint her. So we'll keep you updated on that. We'll link to this op-ed, and we would love it. If you live in Missouri or some of the surrounding states, we would appreciate you circulating this op-ed with your family and friends on Facebook, social media as well, just to get the conversation started on Aaron Hawley and how an excellent fit she would be for the 8th Circuit. Speaking of judicial appointments, this is another duty of the president per the Constitution that has significance on who controls the judiciary moving forward. And we saw President Biden appoint some of the most radical unconstitutional judges to the federal judiciary. And this was one of the reasons why President Trump was elected again in 2024 is because the voters understood the importance of having a president who appoints constitutionalist judges who respect the Constitution, who understand original intent, and understand the core tenets and values that our founding fathers embedded in the Constitution and how to preserve that. And so this is one of those legacies that I believe will not just impact the midterms, because the president needs the majority, his party majority in the U.S. Senate to approve these nominees. If not, then you get a logjam in the Senate, and the ruling party, if it's not the president's party, they won't sign off on some of these judicial nominations, which slows down everything and leaves these vacancies for a long time on the court system. And so both in 2026, the U.S. Senate, obviously there's multiple U.S. Senate seats up, and it's going to be important for Republicans to hold the U.S. Senate in 2026, but it's going to be even more important in 2028 as well to retain control of the U.S. Senate. Because as each of you know, if you listen to American Family Radio and you're at least familiar with how our government is structured and kind of the modern role of judges, for better or worse, in American law and American policy, judges have risen, for better or worse, to a place where they are the ultimate arbiter in many instances of whether our rights are protected or not. That's unfortunate, and it shouldn't be that way. But think about how many cases are decided at the Supreme Court. And the cases that we're talking about are cases of national significance that affect our constitutional rights. And so the judiciary, when you read and understand our founding fathers and their intent on the judiciary was never intended to be as powerful as it is today. As a matter of fact, and I can't think of the name of the founding father, but one of our founding fathers, he was an ambassador. It might have been, well, I'm not going to say names because I don't know. But this founding father was an ambassador, I believe under George Washington, maybe under Jefferson. But he was an ambassador, but he also served on the U.S. Supreme Court. But before he served on the U.S. Supreme Court, he was an ambassador. And to help you understand how the Supreme Court wasn't intended originally to be this grand court with all this power that nine judges can decide on whether you and I have constitutional rights or not, to show how insignificant the Supreme Court was, it had very limited jurisdiction in the founding era of our country. One of our founding fathers even kind of second-guessed about whether he should even serve on the Supreme Court. He was a current ambassador, and then he was asked by the president to come back home and serve on the Supreme Court, and he second-guessed it. He thought, well, I'm actually probably more important as an ambassador and more impactful than I would be on that little Supreme Court back in the District of Columbia. And so but to have that mindset back then shows us that when the Supreme Court originally started by our founding fathers, it wasn't intended to be this know-it-all court that decides on every critical case in our country. It was a very limited court on what it could rule on and the power that it had, etc. And so that's obviously gone to the wayside, unfortunately. But I think we should try to get it back as close as we can to original purpose. And that's why President Trump needs to appoint judges who understand their proper role, their proper jurisdiction per the Constitution, and not judges who want to rule outside of that. Bobby.
It was John Jay.
John Jay.
Yep. Ambassador of Spain and first Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Perfect. There you go, folks. Learn something new every day. John Jay, he questions, should I go back to serve on the Supreme Court? Because that little court wasn't as powerful as it is today, and wasn't a very elaborate court. They didn't even have their own building. They used congressional offices to meet. All right, folks, we'll be back in a few.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to the program. Glad to have you with us on this last segment of At the Core here on American Family Radio. I just dropped that op-ed on Aaron Hawley under the headline notes section, so we'll get that queued up in the show notes. By the way, folks, if you miss out on maybe a news story or something we talk about, Bobby is very good about dropping a lot of the links that we talk about in the show notes section there on the podcast page over at AFR.net. So if you go to today's episode or each day's episode, you can get a lot of the show notes and links there on the webpage at AFR.net. Well, I do want to move on to our next guest. Speaking of, we talked with Operation Christmas Child rep last segment about sharing the gospel, and so we're going to continue that theme here with John Cernilia. He's president of SAT 7, and which is a gospel delivery, content delivery ministry all around the world. And so John's with us now. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Walker. Great to be with you.
Well, John, I'm sure you can describe SAT 7 better than I can. I tried to put it in one sentence, but give our listeners, those who aren't familiar with your ministry, give them a little background about what you guys do.
Yeah, thanks for asking. So we have a heart for people in the Middle East and North Africa specifically, and that's the focus of our ministry. This, of course, is the birthplace of Jesus. It was where the church, the Christian church, was formed. And unfortunately, Walker, among 600 million people, there's only a few million who actually love and follow Jesus in that region of the world. So that's our geographic focus. And the way we bring the gospel is through satellite television and digital media. We reach somewhere between 10 and 20 million people a year in that region, in countries like Iran, with the gospel good news.
Well, let's talk a little technology here. It's fascinating to me how you guys do this, because obviously these countries, many of them, are not going to let you set up shop with a, like we do, an FM radio signal or a television station, right, in these Muslim-majority nations that in many cases have Christianity outlawed. Tell us about the technology, how you guys deliver the gospel into these regions.
Yeah, well, we do it two ways. And in our ethos, our posture is also really important to talk about. So I'll give you the technological answer first. We have four satellite television networks. Satellite cannot be blocked and it cannot be censored. It's an interesting fact technologically about satellite. That's not true about the internet. We've been hearing about how Iran or Afghanistan will literally shut down the internet. That's a problem, of course. However, you can't block satellite, television satellite. So that's how we consistently get the good news in. The other thing I would tell you is, with a few exceptions, most countries actually are comfortable with who we are and what we do because of a few things. First of all, remember, there are families who've been Christian in these countries for centuries. The Nicene Creed was formed 1,700 years ago in Turkey. There are 200,000 Turkish believers in that country. And so they understand, the government leaders understand, their people deserve to have access to information about their religion. And so we actually get broadcast licenses from several countries, which is really cool. The other thing I'll tell you is it's not our place to be critical or to condemn other people or other religions. Our job is simply to share the truth, the good news about Jesus, in ways that perhaps people haven't heard about before.
Yeah, that's a good point. And honestly, for your purposes, with the environment that you're delivering the content in, and the fact that you're actually getting licenses in your instance in Turkey, there's no real grand benefit to, for example, criticizing the government of Turkey or how they operate. The main thing is that you're delivering the gospel, because ultimately that's the heart changer, which we ought to be able to, especially as Americans, we ought to be able to criticize other governments and our own when they're not doing the right thing. But for your purposes, that makes complete sense, that you're narrowly focused on making sure the gospel is delivered. And let me ask you this, John, on, for example, getting a license in Turkey, that's a big deal. That's obviously a Muslim majority nation, pretty not as radical as some of the others, but definitely not Western not Western friendly. Some, not a ton. I know it's nuanced, but What's that like there? I mean, was that difficult, or did you have to get like the U.S. ambassador or State Department involved? I mean, or did you just apply and got granted? I'm interested in that.
Yeah. So a couple of things. We're not an American charity. We're not a Western charity. I lead the U.S. office, which exists to support the work in the region. But we have partners, including the historic church across the region, who stand with us shoulder to shoulder as brothers and sisters. So it's really their call. It's their desire to provide biblical teaching over the television broadcasts for their people. And again, people, including government leaders, understand that this is not a Western faith, although that's a lie that some people will spread about Christianity, that somehow it's an American or British faith. Obviously, that's not true. Right. Jesus walked the earth in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And there are families in many countries in the Middle East who for generations have been following Jesus. So really what we start by saying is we want to serve Christians who live in your country and want to learn more about their God. And we do nothing to criticize governments or other religions. It's simply not our role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point about, you know, the origination of Christianity. Obviously, it originated in that region of the world. Christianity, it's true that it has historically flourished in the West and spread, if you will, in the West. But yeah, anybody who reads their Bible understands that Christianity did not originate in the West. Let me ask you this, John, on the converting of Muslims to Christianity. This has been something that's been talked about for years now, that Muslims all over the world and in some of the most Muslim majority regions of the world are converting to Christianity. Shed a little bit of light on that.
Yeah. So, of course, people are open and searching. We have all kinds of different stories about people who are discovering Jesus. In fact, a common story is that Jesus appears to people in their dreams. This is not a Western phenomena, right? I mean, we don't hear about this happening too much in the U.S., but pretty commonly people come to us and say, a white man in a robe, a man in a white robe, forgive me, appeared to me in my dream. Can you tell me who this might be? And so, of course, we want to be present and available to help people understand that. The other thing is the message of Jesus is radically different than the practices of humanity, right? In my selfishness, in my sinfulness, I might be tempted to treat my wife a certain way. But when I read the gospel and when I hear stories about Jesus and how he related to other people, and what I read and hear about what it means to love, think of 1 Corinthians 13, right? That is radical commentary and language to people, and they're drawn to it. So that's often what will prompt people to seek and to ask questions and to learn more. And we have some incredible stories of life transformation that comes after people decide to follow Jesus.
Mm, amen. Hey, John, once again, we've been talking to John Cernelia with Sat7. Tell our folks your website, how they can read more about your work and the content you guys deliver to these nations.
Yeah, thanks, Walker. So our website address is sat7usa.org. That's S-A-T, the number 7, USA.org. And you go there and you can see all kinds of beautiful stories and testimonies about people who've come to Christ. You can see our video content as well. We also have an app. You can download Sat7 Plus, which is a digital app. And all of our video on demand content is there. So if you want to see a television program happening live in the Middle East, you can click into that and watch that if you're interested.
Very neat. Hey, John, appreciate you coming on and sharing about your work.
Thank you, Walker. Pleasure to be with you.
Yep, absolutely. That URL is sat7usa.org, sat, S-A-T, 7, the number, usa.org. org. You can go and check out that work from Sat 7. John Cernelia is their president. He was just on with us to talk about their work. A story I came across before we wrap up. You know, if you listen to the program, you know I love talking about the economy. And Chris and I will talk about more of this on Friday. But the not all negative headlines are actually negative. Some of them that may come off as a negative headline are actually good news. And here's one out of Fox Business that I came across this morning. More than half of U.S. homes lost value over the last year. And this is data pulled out of the Zillow platform. Zillow data shows highest share of depreciating properties since the tail end of the Great Recession, which ended in roughly 2012. That was the Great Recession brought on by the housing crisis in 08 and 09. And so this, the reason this is good news is because you guys have heard my opinion, and it's not just opinion, but my statements about how overpriced these houses are and these homes are around the country and virtually every part of the country to some degree, some worse than others. But I've said that the affordability problem, the house, the prices have to come down. That's just a fact. They were overly inflated, overly valued, overly priced over the last 3 years since COVID. Really, probably 3 years minimum. Probably could go out to four when you talk about when the real inflation began in 2021. But the only way you get affordability is you get prices down. Rates are not the magic trick. And I know if you listen to President Trump, you would think that interest rates are the magic trick, and they do help. We do need to get rates down a little more, but the prices have to come down. The prices of the assets have to come down. And so as a homeowner, nobody wants to hear that their home is depreciating. But when you look at the almost straight line up in home asset prices over the last 4 years, what did we expect? I mean, this had to come down at some point. And the good news is I don't think they're going to go down much further. I think that even once the dust settles on this depreciating cycle that we're in on home prices, I think once the dust settles, every homeowner, unless you bought a way overly priced house during the inflation under Biden, unless you're in that group, but everybody else, I think we'll still land better off than we were 5 years ago. I still think the asset prices will still be appreciated enough post-COVID to still be pretty good for people who have equity in their house and care about their home asset and their home value, that is. But the prices had to come down. They had to come down, and so they are coming down. So this is good news for people wanting to get into a house or to buy a new house or to sell theirs and move to another house that's affordable. Home prices are coming down. So to be more specific here, reading into this article, more than half of the U.S. homes lost value over the past year, marking the highest share of properties to depreciate in more than a decade. Research from Zillow revealed that approximately 53% of all U.S. homes, so this isn't across the board 100%, roughly half of U.S. homes have lost value since last year, up 14% from a year ago. This is notable given that a share this big has not been seen since the tail end of the Great Recession around 2012, when home prices and household wealth started a meaningful recovery. And so, good news for affordability. I think the depreciation is probably going to continue for the next 6 to 12 months until things level out and interest rates are down to a place where folks can actually afford a house, folks who are especially wanting to get into a first-time home. This has to be resolved. And this is probably going to bode well for President Trump and the economy overall. The housing sector has just been on this euphoric high, And if you were in a home, you were giddy about the asset prices, right? Because you were watching your home appreciate and watching the value of it go up to unrealistic highs. And you can't sustain that. It just has to level out. The market will work itself out. And we are seeing that now. Now, the people who are going to be in a predicament are those who bought into the market at these unrealistic high prices with these insanely high mortgages and high interest rates at 8%. If they're trying to get out, they're going to have some trouble getting out because of the depreciation and the high rates. So we'll keep tracking this, but good news for those trying to get into a home, affordability is on a comeback.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.